Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it. Believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello, and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of a toddler with a sugar rush to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Mark. The other host, Jim, normally does that bit, but he's in the middle of moving house. So we thought, hey, the British Parliament is being prorogued, so we'll prorogue the whole Fallacious Trump studio recording as well. But no, seriously, he's middle of the chaos of moving all that stuff, so actually we haven't been able to get together to record the latest episode, which this week we were going to look at the appeal to fear fallacy. And it occurred to us, actually, what we could do is appeal to fear. Fear, Trump in the White House, the book by Bob Woodward. We have a sister podcast that is available for patrons of the Fallacious Trump podcast, and it's their bonus for doing that patronly thing of subscribing and paying for episodes. And we thought we could give you, the rest of you that don't do that, a sneak preview of the first episode of us covering Fear, Trump in the White House, the Bob Woodward book. It's quite nice to read, knowing that all the things he's talking about have actually kind of come to pass. So it's, it's good fun. We go through it chapter by chapter, and we thought we'd let you in on the secret. We thought you'd might quite enjoy listening to that. Of course, patrons who are already paying for the privilege of listening to this podcast and getting the free gift, obviously we won't charge you for this episode because you've heard it already. And of course, if you enjoy the prologue from Fear, you can catch up with the rest of the chapters that we've been covering in our podcast by becoming a patron. Sign up and subscribe, and you can get 20-odd episodes you could binge over the period that the British Parliament remains prorogued. Lots to talk about next time on Fallacious Trump. Maybe tax returns will appear. We'll take the piss out of Ivanka in Rome. We might have a general election. We might have a British government. Who knows? So we hope you enjoy this bonus episode and join us next time on Fallacious Trump. Follow us in the meantime on Facebook or Twitter. And until we meet again in a couple of weeks' time, we'll leave the last word to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.
The book means nothing. It's a work of fiction. If you look back at Woodward's past, he had the same problem with other presidents.
This idiot Woodward, who wrote this book, which is all fiction, said that I said something like that, but he put it in a very crude manner.
This Woodward book is a total fraud. These people.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to the first episode of our bonus series where we discuss Bob Woodward's book, Fear, Trump in the White House. This is exclusively for patrons. So if you're listening to this, thank you very, very much
thank
for your support.
Thank you very much.
And we hope that this will be, a fun extra little thing that you will enjoy listening to.
Yeah. So, and if you do, let us know. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, we're actually going to start. The book has quite a lot before chapter one. It has a prologue. It also has an author's personal note.
I know, which I found very intriguing. Yeah.
Yeah. Today we're just actually, we're not even going to get to chapter one. We're going to talk about all the stuff that happens before that in the book.
The quote before that.
Yeah.
After the dedication. And then
explains why it's called Fear, yeah.
But also what I find interesting is that later on, Bob Woodward said Trump declined to be interviewed for this book, and yet the first bit in the quote from which Fear comes from, is a real power is, I don't even want to use the word, fear, it comes from an interview with Bob Woodward by Donald Trump.
Well, he's interviewed him a few times actually over the years, but obviously
not
that
specifically
was
for the book,
not for this book, and not about the events that are covered in the book. So I presume partly because Woodward got a lot of background stuff from the other people that he interviewed, and would have liked, in fact, he tried several times to get an interview with Trump to talk to him about some of the stuff he'd found out from other people. Trump claimed that none of his staff ever told him that Woodward had been trying to get hold of him to do an interview with him.
Yeah.
So
there you go.
Yeah.
And I think just along along the lines of last episode of Fallacious Trump, when he denied that the Russians were trying to get hold of him to share some information with him or his son-in-law. Yeah.
So there's a lot of books about Trump. And one of them that's just come out is by Stormy Daniels, for example. There's Omarosa's book.
What's
I actually don't know, to be honest, Stormy Daniels' book.
It just occurs to me that the ones I've read all start with F. So there's Fire and the Fury and Fear.
That's true.
And maybe Stormy Daniels just fuck.
It could start with an F, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is actually, it does start with an F. It's called Full Disclosure.
Ah.
So, yeah, F Trump. All these books.
And we're there, we're there.
There's, I think Omarosa's book is, I think, called something like Unhinged or something like that, but also made with lots of tapes. But really, realistically, Bob Woodward has a little bit more cachet, shall we say, a little bit more journalistic experience and gravitas. Yeah. He's a bit of an elder statesman of journalism.
And interesting what you, in the opening title tune, Sting, that Trump kind of denies that. He said, if you look at him, he's got a terrible track record of previous presidents. You go, well, no, that's precisely what he does have. He's a great track record.
Absolutely. He's written books about various other presidents.
Mm.
Obviously, most famously about Nixon, but about pretty much, I think, certainly Bush and Obama, he's written books about, and I think Clinton as well. Yeah, he's quite well versed in this world.
Yes.
And
he knows how to
And the critic Clive James, who's an Australian critic who's very popular in the UK and I think actually made it into the US as well, he said of Woodward that he checks his facts until they weep with boredom. So he's generally seen to be reliable, let's say that.
And in fact, the author's personal note ahead of the prologue actually kind of talks about the process by which they gathered this information. And even in the note to readers, they talk about the deep background. So there's about hundreds of hours of interviews with and taped and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot going on with reams and reams of paper. And
He says
so he kind of lays down all his credentials.
The people he talked to allowed him to tape record their interviews so that the story could be told with more precision. Obviously, not all of them, he was doing it using deep background rules. So that meant that he wasn't going to attribute necessarily, unless they gave him permission, what they said to them. But the fact that he has tapes means that I suppose if anyone.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how you would use those. It's obviously they're used to make sure that what he's writing is precise, because he would have gone back to the tapes originally. But you can't really, I suppose, use it for debunking someone saying, "Oh, this is all bollocks. I never said that."
Yeah,
you've told them that you're not going to reveal the ones
kind
who said
of
it.
It's stuff talked about in the confessional, isn't it? So it's it's stuff that you can't really turn over. But I suspect at some point, if they need to, the FBI will go, "Do you know what, Bob? We're going to have them for that." Isn't that the plot of the post, though? So what's interesting, I find, about the other bit of Trump's insistence at the head of the Sting is that he says several times that it's fiction. And I think it's so despite those statements at the beginning ahead of the prologue of the credentials and the authenticity of where all this material comes from, the way he's then set the book out it uses the structure of a storybook, much like Michael Wolff's Fire and the Fury did, which makes...
Yeah, we call them novels.
Yeah. Did I say storybooks? Yeah.
You said
So it's a... it's like, it's the Gruffalo, isn't it? It's
that, yeah.
He is the Gruffalo.
Yeah, those are the kind of books that Trump reads, the storybooks.
Yeah. I think they're probably more picture books that happen to have a narrative, And so where I think Trump is getting his fiction from is that the idiom that Woodward has used is of a fictionalised account of what's going on in order to make it terribly compelling to keep reading. And it is, God, it's such a good read.
Yeah, and it works to draw you in rather than just being kind of dry facts and this is what this person said and they were lying and here's the information. It does tell the story. That's why Woodward is as good as he is, really.
And it's a proper documentary, isn't it? And my issue with it, I guess, was in this world of story and worrying about where the facts are coming from and Trump dismissing everything as works of fiction. I guess what I wanted was a concordance, a book that goes along with it that you can refer to that's got the very documents that they're talking about. So you can see in black and white the date and time stamp of where this was going on so you can verify the story. I just feel in the post-Trump world that I need that kind of fact to hold on to. So if anybody came and went, oh, well, that's just completely made up, you can go, it isn't. Look, here
you
are.
Want you want the book to come with a dossier.
Yes, exactly.
Documentary evidence.
To just back it all up. So if anybody dismisses it, because I get this sense that this is going to be quite a divisive book and, dismissed as a fiction
by the Republicans certainly the Trump-supporting Republicans and lapped up by the Democrats. And maybe Mike Pence will go, well, yeah, this is what's going on. Here it is. This is my lodestar. Yeah.
So it's the prologue starts with a story which actually really made the rounds when the book was due to come out. This was one of the stories that kind of was on all the news, which is about Gary Cohn stealing a letter from the president's desk. Which tells me that the journalists who talked about this probably got a copy of the book and read the first few pages and went, oh, we should just say this. We should just just talk about this. We don't need to read the whole thing and then, pick out interesting bits. This is enough. So, because it was just everywhere, this story. So you've already heard it, I'm sure. But basically... it was about a letter that Trump supposedly had on his desk about withdrawing from a trade agreement with South Korea. And Gary Cohn, who was a kind of top economic advisor to the president, while he was in the Oval Office, for some reason, saw the letter on the desk, thought, that's bad. We can't send that because bad things will happen. So he took the letter off the desk so that Trump wouldn't be able to sign it and send it and withdraw from the United States Korea Free Trade Agreement.
Because the implication for national security and having troops stationed there and being in the vicinity of any intercontinental ballistic missile launch from
and
the northern
neighbors.
This is the
thing, Trump just doesn't understand that why South Korea is important, why they need to be an ally. He says later on in the prologue, he says, why is the US paying $1 billion a year for an anti-ballistic missile system in South Korea? And he said he threatened to pull it out of South Korea and move it to Portland, Oregon. He doesn't understand that if the North Koreans were to launch a weapon at the US, they might notice it earlier in South Korea.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And nobody in Oregon is going to launch a missile towards the White House. Yeah.
So, yeah, and it says... it says that in Alaska, kind of watching from Alaska to see if North Korea launches a missile, they would know 15 minutes after it was launched.
Ooh,
but
yeah.
if they have this base in South Korea, if they have the troops, the US troops in South Korea and the anti-ballistic missile system, they would know within 7 seconds of a launch.
Wow.
And they would be able to shoot it down.
Well, yeah.
Before it had a chance to get anywhere near the US.
And it also, so he kind of, he doesn't get the interconnectedness of all things.
No.
Not, you know, and also ignoring the Korean War anyway, which kind of, you know, the reason it's fucked up is due in no small part because of America anyway. So part of it is paying their dues and maintaining peace in that part of the world, which they ruined.
Sure, part of it is, but the least important part in terms of national security and defence.
Yeah, yeah.
And even if that was all it was, you kind of, I mean, I wouldn't agree with Trump, but you can see where he's coming from if he says, well, you know, why are we doing all this stuff? Why are we spending so much money to help South Korea? It's not helping South Korea.
No.
The fact that you get to be in South Korea so that you know what the North Koreans are doing is absolutely
That's the
vital.
Point. Yeah, yeah.
Especially if in your second year you decide to poke the North Koreans as hard as you can with a big stick.
Yeah.
And hope they don't fire a nuclear missile at you.
Yes, exactly. What I find also interesting in the book, like we're in paragraph 2 of the prologue, and you know, 5 words in, he goes cone hyphen 6'3", bald, brash, and full of self confidence. So you get that, and you get kind of parentheses, and so he's poised to go into the room, and you can see what he looks like. So he's going to fill the door frame. And so he's not, it's, I guess that's to set it up to, so he's a big guy. He's not going to go in the room unnoticed. He's then got to secrete,
steal this letter
off the thing and shove it in his back pocket or in his jacket or something somehow.
Yeah.
But I guess also,
Woodward also does that with Rob Porter.
Right.
Who he describes as 6'4", rail thin, 40 years old, and raised a Mormon, which is a great description. That tells you everything lovely, you need to know.
Yeah, yeah. And then follows that with, was one of the grey men. And you go, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, he's Elder Porter. Yeah. Uh-huh. So he's been out. He's been doing the evangelistic knocking on doors stuff.
Yeah.
He was called Elder Porter at some stage.
Yeah, so Cone and Porter kind of worked together, basically, to make sure that no matter how many versions of this letter were produced, they never got sent. And even at one point, Trump dictated a letter. He was basically just seemed to be constantly pissed off that they were still in this free trade agreement.
Yeah.
I think he kind of occasionally looked around and go, didn't I say we shouldn't do that? Didn't I get Paulette out of that? Oh, we'll have to do it again. And so apparently he dictated a new letter to Kushner. Well, he dictated a letter basically to the room, and Kushner was the nearest person to him, so he took it down.
Finish
that letter and I'll sign it. And Cone and Porter got involved again and said, oh, yeah, you need to send a draft of that to me so that we can do it properly. And they showed Trump the draft and then basically told him, you know, it's not ready. There's lots of stuff we need to talk about. We need to do things. And it says smothered the president with facts and logic. Which is brilliant. That's kind of what we're trying to do.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So just to kind of bore him and distract him and just go, oh, look, a shiny thing. And so
Trump said, well, okay, let's keep working on the letter. Show me the next draft. And they just never did. And that was enough because he's a fucking idiot. So he He has never, and maybe, I don't know if he's, I mean, he's not going to read this, but maybe he'll get someone to read it to him.
Oh, no, that was my other worry. Yeah, he's going to read this in the chapter. He'll go, oh, that's what happened to it. Oh, where is it?
I need to do that.
Yeah. Where is it? You guys, what are you doing? Yeah. Uh-huh. Wow.
So basically, in the end, they had to get Jim Mattis to explain to Trump why South Korea was an important ally. It's not just about trade. And
it's not just the cost of it, it's the value of it.
Yes. Yeah. And it's not clear from the prologue whether that actually went in, whether he understood or anything. But it seems like that was...
It's a nice scene setter because it kind of describes the chaos and the people that work there. It's the people working behind the scenes, of which Mike Pence, possibly Lowestar, is one of them. And it kind of sets it up so that there are people working together, despite the president, to stop him doing stuff and having to do it over and over again with the same... So his illustration is they're doing it with the same memo. So it's kind of setting it up from what we know about his repetitive nature that we're going to be faced with that. So it is an exciting... It's a pre-credit sequence, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the... This could lead into the voiceover of Mike Pence walking up the lawn into the White House saying, I know, I am one of them. Yeah, and what I really also like is that you get a facsimile of the memo. And what they didn't do is, like, burn the memo.
They
take it away and bury it in the garden.
Keep written on it.
Yes, exactly, so.
Yeah. I don't know how many copies. I wonder how many copies they eventually had.
Yeah.
Like, scrapbooking with them.
Yeah, but, yeah. And why is it in a folder called keep rather than destroy?
Yeah, not send.
Yes, do not send. Don't even open it. Do not open until Christmas. Yeah, send to Obama.
At some point, someone is going to make a film of this book. They have to.
Yeah.
It will be, maybe it'll be like All the President's Men or
I've got a horrible feeling Ron Howard will end up directing it.
It could be, yeah. It'll be. So in the story, in the film of this book, who would you cast? Yeah. In the parts that we've covered so far in the prologue, we've got Gary Cohn.
Yeah.
We've got Roy Porter.
Rob Porter,
sorry.
So Gary Cohn, possibly Kevin Spacey.
Kevin Spacey's kind of small, isn't he?
So
it makes me think of Verbalkin. Go on.
I was going to say the guy that played Drax in Guardians of the Galaxy, so Dave Bautista.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd have him.
Gone completely the other way.
Right.
I tell you who I think is my pick is Dean Norris, who is Hank from Breaking Bad.
Oh, nice! Yes.
So, Rob Porter.
Rob Porter, you're not going to like this. Matthew Perry.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Because of something about Chandler when he had that job as a... When he got the job and everybody hated him and because he became management. Something about that.
Yeah. See, I think maybe Matthew Perry during the Vicodin years when he was...
Right.
He had like season 3 and 4, I think. He had some painkiller addiction problems, and he got really thin. And that maybe he's just recently actually played Ted Kennedy
in a
miniseries about Camelot and stuff.
Yeah. That'd be
interesting.
Good. And also, I think that because Dave Bautista would be the kind of big bruisey kind of guy, with or without the tattoos. But so you need a kind of comic foil.
Like a double act. for me, Rob Porter, mm-hmm. although I don't think either of them are the same height, because I just don't like Rob Porter because he's a wife beater and an asshole. I also don't like Casey Affleck. I'm not a fan. Don't like him. I think he'd do a good Rob Porter.
Or
Joaquin Phoenix, who I also have an irrational dislike of. You need to be a bit kind of slimy, a bit weaselly and
a propensity to grow an enormous beard.
Has he?
Well, both of those.
Rob Porter. Oh, those two have.
The actors, yeah.
Rob Porter, I thought. yeah. No, they do. That's true. They do both. They have both done that. So
usually, yeah.
The most important part of this movie.
Yeah.
Who would play Trump in your version?
Well, because in the book, Bob Woodward says, that Bannon says, he's Archie Bunker. So... You know, and the nearest we've got to
Carol O'Connor is dead. So
yeah, I know. So the nearest we've got to Archie Bunker is probably John Goodman.
Yeah, Goodman would be good. Although for me, he was such a perfect Rex Tillerson in Saturday Night Live. I don't know if I can pick a better Rex Tillerson, so I don't want to take him out of that position. I want to keep him free for me.
Yeah.
For that. So I've got a few thoughts for Trump. I mean, it's Alec Baldwin is amazing as Trump in Saturday Night Live. But I think that's too easy. I think Gary Busey has the right combination of the kind of physicality and the just pure craziness to do Trump.
Yeah,
I think he could do it.
Yeah.
You could believe him as a total nut job because he is. So I think that could work. I think an interesting thought that I heard recently is Martin Sheen, who obviously is Jed Bartlett in The West Wing, could not possibly have been less like Trump, but I think he could do it. I think he hates Trump with a passion. So if it was a negative portrayal, which it would, I think he.
Well, he played Kennedy, didn't he?
He did. Yeah.
JF Kennedy
But I kind of leaning towards Gary Busey because. Just the comedy.
No, I'll go along with that. Plus, he's got the hair already.
Absolutely.
So, I'll go along with that. Yeah. Okay. What about Jim Mattis?
Jim Mattis. See, it's a bit more difficult, that one.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of. See, I think actually Kevin Spacey is more of a Jim Mattis type. He's probably not quite. I would want to see someone who you could believe, and I don't know about Jim Mattis at all, but I feel like under his uniform, he's kind of like he works out, he's built,
right?
Even though he's quite small framed, I feel like he could put you down. And I'm not sure I feel that way about Kevin Spacey. I think I need someone who seems like he might be dangerous.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, well, I was going to go for the comedy factor, and actually, if he was still alive, I don't know, maybe he's not dead, I would actually pick Slim Pickens.
Okay.
Mainly because of the not dissimilar facial features. It's a bit kind of Droopy the Dog, Jim Mattis, isn't
he? He is, yeah.
So that kind of, oh dear, oh my, but Slim Pickens, and also there's the throwback connection to Dr. Strangelove.
Yes. Not only is Slim Pickens no longer with us, he died in 1983.
Wow.
That's a while.
So, who's the modern equivalent of Slim Pickens? We want that kind of...
Bill Murray, if he lost, I don't know how... How kind of 40 bulky is now. Bill Murray is at the moment, or if he's lost a bit of weight, but I can see him
Yeah. Or Chevy Chase.
That might be interesting. Chevy Chase is quite husky these days. He's quite, last thing I saw him in was Community, which he's great in.
Right.
But, I don't know, I could see, I'll come back to Chevy, I think, for another another chapter.
Okay. Because you see, what we've done is mainly cast it with comedians.
Yeah.
Funnily enough.
Well, but, would it be, what kind of film would it be? Would it be a comedy? This, if they made Fear. It wouldn't be a political thriller. I don't think they could do that.
No.
Could they?
Might it be a caper movie? You know, so like the new Michael Caine gold heist thing.
Yeah.
Could you do it as if it was a plot to do one last big job, you know, before we all retire?
Being president. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of that. So you just go, well, you know, there's Trump. Because there's this implication throughout the book and through Michael Wolff's book and, you know, various gags that we talk about, that it was never their intention to win.
Yeah.
And that would make it perfect sense. So it was something that there's this massive, crazy plot. And so,
it's kind of like the producers, but political version.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they...
it's all gone horribly wrong and now they have to run the country.
Yeah. But it starts up, but Trump is completely unaware of that. He's none the wiser. So he's really going for it. He's going, oh, yeah, I'll do it. You know, we're talking about, I'll give it a go. So they kind of, they realise that, so it's a cross between a caper movie and Frankenstein. So they realise they made this monster and then they can't switch it off. They can't stop doing it. And you know, to get all the way to the polling booths, and realize, oh my God, our worst nightmares come true. He's won. You know, we thought we could just retire, but no, he's won. So, would you have a as is the kind of fashion these days to have a Brit play the villain, play a villain?
Yeah.
What about if we cast a Brit as Trump? Who would that be? A fancy Patrick Stewart in a wig.
Ken Stott. I think.
Yeah, that's going to mean nothing to anybody outside of these shores.
Or Brendan Gleeson. How about Brendan Gleeson? He could do it.
As Trump, yeah.
Yeah,
as
Trump.
He's doing a nice line in Catholic Priests these days, isn't he?
Yeah.
He was
also great in Paddington 2. Knuckles McGinty.
Yes, exactly. It was indeed, yeah. Ken Stott, I reckon, would make a good Bannon.
Yeah, that's true. Our next episode, where we will cover chapter one, we'll cover, I suppose, mainly Bannon's introduction to Trump and to the campaign. Uh-huh. We'll be back with that in 2 weeks' time. In the week in between two Fallacious Trump episodes. And thanks again very much for your support as a patron. And we will see you then. I hope you've enjoyed this first episode and will stick with us.
And if you'd like to read along, get hold of the book and read up chapter and make any comments on, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts.
And at the rate of one chapter every 2 weeks, it should only take us about 18 months to get through the book.
Yeah, hopefully that'll be the end of the presidency.
And that's the end of that chapter.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.